everyone, and welcome to episode 56 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. This week's episode is brought to you by Podcorn, a new online marketplace where podcasters and sponsors can connect to bring the best of both worlds to you, the listener. Sponsors upload information about themselves, who they are, what they care about, and what they offer. And podcasters do the same, using the list feature to see what's out there and to find the best fit. Podcorn makes it possible for both sponsors and podcasters to collaborate and come up with content that works for everybody, especially you, so that you get the information that you can use. I like it because it gives me freedom, creativity, and flexibility, so I don't have to rely on ads that just don't work for us. So thanks, Podcorn, for sponsoring today's journey into the medieval world. To find out more about Podcorn and how it works, check out podcorn.com. These days, a lot of us are stuck inside looking for a distraction, so why not turn to one of the world's most popular ones? Video games. It seems like casual and hardcore gamers alike can't get enough of the medieval world, so this week, I talked to Dr. Alicia McKenzie to get the skinny on medieval video games. Alicia is an instructor in the history department at Wilfrid Laurier University and at Conestoga College, and she's created and taught all sorts of fun medieval courses, including ones on Game of Thrones and Skyrim. She's just putting the finishing touches on her new book, which has the working title Recreating Worlds: Representations of Pre-Modern History in Video Games. Alicia and I chatted about the world's love affair with medieval-themed video games, what some of the ups and downs of this are, and which games she recommends for medieval fans staying at home. Thanks, Alicia, for joining me to talk about medieval video games. I'm so happy to talk to you about this today.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, too.
All right, so I have played some medieval video games. I played World of Warcraft, and I played Lord of the Rings, but these are all kind of not quite medieval. Do you have a favorite game that you like to talk about when you start thinking about video games?
Do I have a favorite game? Well, probably Witcher 3, which is, again, not quite medieval. It's neo-medieval. Actually, a lot of them are. That's one of the things I noticed when I first started working in this area. There are very few video games that are actually set in the real Middle Ages, which is interesting to me.
When you say neo-medieval, what does that mean for people who haven't come across that term before?
So neo-medieval is sort of, to borrow a phrase from a favorite author of mine, the Middle Ages that never were. So it's something that looks medieval, that feels medieval, that has a lot of the features of medieval society and culture, but which is not actually set in the historical Middle Ages. And usually it crosses over to at least some degree with fantasy. So that's an excuse to have, you know, magic and strange creatures and so forth as part of your storyline. And most of the big role-playing games that are medieval-ish are, in fact, neo-medieval.
I think that's definitely true. Why do you think people go for the neo-medieval instead of the strictly medieval when it comes to video games?
Well, I think in some ways it's more fruitful ground for developing the video game in the first place. You can include... Well, actually, my most recent theory is that a neo-medieval world gives you social mobility. So you can start from being the level 1 character who knows nothing and is barely surviving to the level 20 character who is the hero of the realm. And if you were going to set this in the actual Middle Ages, that type of thing, not quite so possible.
That's true, because you start out as a peasant, you're pretty much going to stay as a peasant, unless you're super lucky. But again, in these big role-playing games, everybody is getting to be a hero, which is not going to happen in the real Middle Ages. So you actually study video games as a book that you're working on. What brought you to studying video games as a part of getting into medieval history?
Well, it actually came about as it kind of came out of a course I teach, which is a survey course on contemporary medievalism in pop culture. And I noticed I had my students do an assignment where they talked about their previous encounters with medievalism. And I noticed that almost all of them, whether they were actual medieval studies students or people taking it as an elective, they gamed. So it was like a universal experience for them. And so I thought, you know, we should be looking into this as a way to develop further courses. And I myself had been a gamer when I was younger, so it wasn't too hard to get back into it. And I think after I played Skyrim for about 6 hours, I was totally lost. Like, at that point, it was just that was what I was doing now. And, you know, I would just have to go forward with it.
Yeah, I think Skyrim is probably the one that seems to be the most popular at the moment. Like, you and I have taught the same course on the Middle Ages. We're still teaching this course. And everybody has to write at least one essay on Skyrim. What is it about Skyrim that draws people?
I think it's two things. I think, first of all, it was possibly the first truly immersive medievalist video game, where you walk into the world, basically. You wake up in the middle of a situation you don't understand and you discover it as the character. And the other thing I think is, which makes Skyrim such a perennial favorite, is how customizable the experience is. I mean, you can be anything in Skyrim. You can be the warrior who's the head of the companions. You can be the head of the mages. You can be the head of the assassins. Or you can be all of those things at the same time. So you can play Skyrim 50 times and have 50 completely different experiences.
And does this one borrow a lot from the Middle Ages, the actual Middle Ages, or is this one really far off into fantasy?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, because basically my answer is yes and no. Kevin and Brent Moberly wrote an article about Skyrim years ago, which was a huge inspiration for me when I first started getting into doing gaming. And they talked about how Skyrim, in a lot of ways, when you look at things like the houses and the villages and so forth, it's like a living history museum. So the individual houses look just as they should. But then when you look at other buildings, if you think about Whiterun, which is the first city that you encounter in Skyrim, the Jarl's Palace is like a cross between, it's almost like a stave church that's sitting on Romanesque foundations. So there are other influences there, of course. And Skyrim has this fantastic way of sort of moving along the spectrum from things that look historical to things that look more fantastical. So, you know, when you start off in Skyrim, you're wearing armor that looks very historical. But as you get farther into the game and you pick up new gear, you wind up looking, if you want, like something out of Lord of the Rings. So it's like it starts you off in familiar territory and then moves you into the fantastical. And I think that's part of its success as well. So,
yeah, and you're bringing up Lord of the Rings, and I think that's a huge inspiration for a lot of fantasy games. Do you think that's a fair thing to say?
Oh, I think so. Lord of the Rings, but also Lord of the Rings is mediated through Dungeons and Dragons. that's one of the things I discovered while I was working on my book, is how foundational D&D is to the way medievalist video games work.
How does that work then? How does D&D influence these games now?
Well, the basic class structure, for instance, is, you know, it's not transferred intact, but it certainly influences. You know, you've got the warrior, the rogue, the mage. These are classic D&D archetypes, right? You have hit points, you have spells, you have limited resources, which is another reflection of D&D. Yeah, there's a lot of D&D DNA in medievalist video games, I would say.
Yeah, I guess when you think about it, like, Dungeons and Dragons was a huge phenomenon back in the 70s and early 80s. And I guess it just makes sense that it would transfer to the virtual realm, because it has a lot of things that work pretty well. Medievalism has been with video games pretty much since the beginning, right? Like, what were some of the early medieval video games that came out?
Well, I will tell you about my very first computer game, actually. It was the first King's Quest game.
Nice.
Which was basically like a sort of almost like a side-scrolling adventure game. You were a young Squire Graham who had to save the ill king and save the kingdom. And I remember my mother and I, because I was having trouble winning the game. So we actually created, because you would move from screen to screen, and we had to create a map to figure out where things were. So we actually drew the world map of King's Quest as I was having trouble beating the game. But I still, I found it online on an emulator back when I first taught my gaming course and had my students play it together in class. They hated it. They were like, this is Oh, good. This is ancient. Why are you making us do this? I'm like, this is the granddaddy of them all. You've got to appreciate the classics, right? It was fun.
Yeah, I think that students these days would have a hard time going back to those real pixely video games, but I remember them. I think one of my early video games is Conan, so not medieval, but it was very much like very pixely. But I was thinking of well, even it's a long time ago now, but when Nintendo came out and people were playing The Legend of Zelda, right?
Oh yes.
You had to get
Yeah.
involved. What about that one? What drew people to that one, do you think, as a medieval video game?
Well, I think one of the things that earlier medievalist video games shared was the classic hero's journey, right? You start off as this young hero, you build yourself into, this mighty character who's solving problems, saving the kingdom, that sort of thing. Final Fantasy, the early ones are very similar, I would say, in that sense, to Legend of Zelda. It's Japanese medievalism, don't even get me started there with how much it's influenced video games. But yeah, I think it's interesting. I do think that a lot of the earlier games sort of parallel medieval romance in a way, or even the medieval epic. There's a lot of potential influences there, so.
Yeah, let's dig in for a second. So, how do they parallel romance or epics, do you think, in the storytelling?
In terms of romance, obviously, you're talking about stories of the great deeds of heroes and so forth. And I would say more recently, with the introduction of like romance, like actual romance options in a lot of these medievalist video games, I'm thinking of Dragon Age, for instance. That brings it even closer to the standard themes and tropes of medieval romance, when you actually are out there doing your knightly deeds with your beloved by your side, accompanying you, and so forth. In terms of epic, you do have the hero saving his people. Yeah, I don't know. That's not something that I tend again to stray more towards how it incorporates history and actual aspects of real world medieval culture. But I think there's a lot to be done with the literary parallels as well. It's just not something I had delved into too deeply yet.
Well, luckily enough, I wanted to switch gears to history now, so that works very well. Because there's a lot of video games that now really kind of bank on the idea that they are based on history, that they are close to history, and that they'll teach you a little bit about history. So, what kind of things are you seeing there? What are some games that are coming out that really kind of focus on history, or at least what they want people to learn about history?
Well, it depends on genre too. I mean, if you're talking about strategy games, which is an area I don't cover in my book because the nature of the medievalism in a strategy game is incredibly different than the nature of a medievalism in a role-playing game. Things like Crusader Kings 2 and Crusader Kings 3 that are coming out within the year. What that allows people to do is almost to play with history, to experiment with counterfactuals. I know a lot of my students, for instance, play Crusader Kings 2, and they just get a kick out of reversing the way things actually happen in history. Oh, look, the Mongols are ruling England, that sort of thing. They really enjoy that. And I think the strategy games are becoming much more complex, and they're working in new mechanics that allow you to look at just the influence of things beyond warfare. So the influence of cultural exchange, economic exchange. And that definitely encourages people playing them to think in more sophisticated terms about the actual Middle Ages. And I'm a big fan of that. I'm not a big fan of playing strategy games, to be honest. I find them kind of boring as a player, but from a historical standpoint, I see their worth. And it's always fascinating to hear students talking about their experiences with it. So now, role-playing games is a bit different. It's a lot subtler because it's part of, in most cases, it's part of the world building. So they want to make the world that you're immersed in look medieval. And part of the fun is, how realistic are you going to go? So there's a game, Kingdom Come Deliverance, which prides itself on realism. It was a game that was funded initially through a Kickstarter, and I believe they advertised themselves as Skyrim without dragons. Now, I've played Kingdom Come, and I have a lot of respect for the amount of work that went into it and the obvious dedication to the setting, to the way that people interacted. to me, there's a lot of realism in it. Unfortunately, I also discovered I really suck at that game because I can't pick locks. So I only got part of the way through, but enough to see how they were making use of history. And the interesting thing in that case is that it's their own history. I mean, it's a game that's set in 15th century Bohemia, and it's a Czech game studio. So they're delving into their own history, exploring their heritage. And you see something similar with The Witcher games and CD Projekt Red in Poland, because The Witcher novels, which inspired the games, were the product of a very famous Polish author. And like most medievalist things, they do say as much about the modern world, of course, as they do about the Middle Ages. But it's fascinating to see the meaning that people can find in these fictional representations of their own history. And you kind of understand why they want to have this world to immerse themselves in. It gets them more in touch with their own heritage in a way.
Yeah, I've heard that. I haven't played Kingdom Come Deliverance, but I've heard that this one is very much, is almost local history, because you're dropped into that world. And if you looked around it, you'd see kind of cities and villages that looked like it would have looked at the time. And so you get to play in, as you say, in your own history. And it's very localized. And yet it's become a real hit on a global scale as well. I do want to bring up Assassin's Creed, because I think that kind of brought people into role-playing in history. But that one, I might be wrong about this, but that one takes place a little bit later than the Middle Ages, doesn't it? Even the first one?
Well, the first one actually takes place during the Second Crusade, I think. It's the 1100s, definitely. And then the more popular ones picked up in the Renaissance. And what's interesting about Assassin's Creed is that for almost the whole lifespan of the franchise, they were moving forward in time. They actually made it all the way to the 19th century. But then the two most recent ones, which are a reboot of the franchise in a lot of ways, everything from the overarching story to the game mechanics, they went far back in time. So they had the Assassin's Creed Origins, which was set during the Ptolemaic period in Egypt, and then most recently Assassin's Creed Odyssey, which is set during the Peloponnesian War. And I think they've created a new standard for games set in history. Anything that comes out that's set in the pre-modern world is going to be compared to those two games, simply because of just how much incredible time and effort Ubisoft put into making this fully fleshed out world. And I was hugely impressed by both of them. It's not just on the visual level, it's also on the cultural level. It's absolutely fascinating. And I mean, part of it is that they work with so many scholars of so many different disciplines. When I was writing my chapter about Assassin's Creed Odyssey, I discovered that not only had they talked to actual historians, they had talked to experimental archaeologists to figure out how everyday tasks would be carried out in the markets and so forth. And it's just fantastic. I mean, I love both games. I'm crossing my fingers that the next one, the rumors is that it's a Viking period one. I would really love to see that, but I tend to suspect it's probably set in Rome just because of the nature of the story so far. But I would love to see them take on the Vikings. I really would.
Just give it some time. Yeah, I wanted to bring up Assassin's Creed, and you bring up Vikings, and these kind of dovetail nicely, because I think that Assassin's Creed, it kind of messes with history in a way that really was popular, and that it makes the Knights Templar the bad guys and it makes the Assassins the good guys. And it's really influenced, I think, how people are looking at the Templars now. And so I wanted to get into how you think video games are using the Middle Ages, and how this can be good and how this can be bad.
Well, I think more recently they are using the Middle Ages in a much more productive way than they used to. I'm going to give you the example of the Dragon Age series, the third one, Dragon Age Inquisition. I took a very close look at that for the purposes of doing a conference presentation and then an article on it fairly recently. And what I realized is that, you know, this is a game that the franchise initially started out looking very much like a simple dark fantasy game and set in a pseudo-medieval world. But over the course of the following games, it's developed to a point where the developers are thinking really hard about the nature of the medieval world that they want to portray. So by the time you hit the third game, what we're seeing is actually a medieval world that is reflecting some of the assumptions that we now have about what the Middle Ages look like, where it's this cosmopolitan world where different cultures are in contact with each other, where institutions are not just shaping social and cultural life, but also being shaped by other trends within social and cultural life. And all in all, I think this is something that we see reflected in other more modern games as well. And I do think it's encouraging gamers to think more creatively and more critically about what the medieval actually is, what a medieval world does look like. It's not simplified anymore. It's with these open world games, I mean, you have to have a fully fleshed out world. You have to have a world that has a society that you're existing within, that has cultures surrounding you. And so, you know, they can't just draw on medieval literature and the tropes of medieval romance anymore. To create a world, you have to use a world as inspiration. So that, I think, is why we see so much more of medieval history and medieval institutions and cultures in the games that have been coming out within the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, I think you're right in that. I think it's starting to change in that it used to be very black and white. You know, people are very dirty, they're very violent, that's all they do, just swing swords and hurt people. And I do think that's starting to change in how complex these games are starting to be. Do you think that's something that people are noticing as they're playing? Do you think that's changing most people's perception of the Middle Ages? Like, you think that's evolving a bit?
I'm hoping so. I think part of the problem is that so much of the depth of these games is optional. I mean, you don't necessarily understand the complexity of the world unless, say, you read every book that you pick up, or you talk to your companion characters and find out about their lives and so forth. It is entirely possible to just go rampaging through one of these games and play it on the shallowest possible level and miss all of this detail below the surface. And I think the game studios have to take into account that there are people who are going to want to do that, so they leave that open as an option. And that can actually backfire in fairly scary ways. So take Skyrim, for instance. I mean, you can play Skyrim and read everything and think really hard about it and think, first time I played Skyrim, I was like, this isn't about Vikings at all. This is like an allegory of the fall of the Roman Empire and the relationship with the Germanic peoples. And they even have Talos as Arius and all of this great stuff. But then you can also play Skyrim and join the Stormcloaks and live out a white supremacist fantasy. So, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword, that level of flexibility, and it can cause some really nasty consequences. I don't think Bethesda ever wanted to have Stormfront's favorite video game, but they certainly wound up with it. And I'm going to be curious to see how they avoid that in The Elder Scrolls VI.
Yeah, so I haven't played Skyrim, so you have to walk me through this a little bit. How is it that they're playing out a white supremacist fantasy? Because I do know that this is something that is happening in some video games, but I don't know a lot about how it happens in particular video games. So how does that work in a game like Skyrim?
Well, the key with Skyrim is that it's set in the province of Skyrim, in the, you know, the game world of Tamriel. And the native race in the province are the Nords, who are blonde and blue-eyed and burly and, you know, carry axes, and their houses look like Viking houses, Scandinavian houses, rather, and so forth. And they're set up as being in rebellion against the Empire, which is, you know, a southern decadent group that's trying to control them and how they worship. So it's really easy for people who are already kind of leaning in that direction to see, you know, parallels to, you know, modern day white supremacist ideas. And the problem with Skyrim is that one of the core storylines is a Civil War storyline, where you have to pick one faction or the other to ally with. And in an effort to not make it too black and white, the developers gave both factions flaws. And unfortunately, one of the flaws they gave the Stormcloaks, so the Nord rebels, is that they're xenophobic to the point of being racist. Okay. And there are a lot of people that played it from certain constituencies, if you want to call it that, who kind of liked the xenophobia and the racism. You know, they like the war cry for the Stormcloaks is Skyrim for the Nords.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I think we should make it clear for the people who are listening that we are not saying that this is, you know, necessarily indoctrinating people. And I think that what you're saying is probably very true, and that you probably have a certain mindset before you even show up to Skyrim. Oh, yes.
Well, I'll say what I said to my students when we talked about Skyrim. As I said, I taught a group of 150 first-year students about this this game as a way to kind of get at medieval history. And what I said to them when we brought this up, I said, you know, just because racists like Skyrim doesn't make you a racist. It just means that they see something in this game that they've chosen to interpret a particular way. And that, in fact, playing Skyrim and being aware of that, being critical about that, and knowing that that's a possibility makes you, you know, just it just makes you a more thoughtful person. It doesn't make you a racist. So,
yeah.
Nobody gets tarred with that brush just because they happen to like playing Skyrim. I like playing Skyrim. I've played through the game about 10 times by now. I'm certainly not a racist. So,
yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, as we're saying, it's not the game that will make somebody a racist, but it is troubling that that kind of is a vehicle for that online. And I know that's something that lots of scholars have noticed and picked up on. And hopefully people are looking at this game and they're using critical thinking, as you're saying, because I think that that thinking can apply to the entire Middle Ages, right? You can pick a storyline and go with that. That will feed into, you know, your own racist ideals. And that's not what we want.
Teams are getting much better about it in any case. What I've noticed as I've been working on my book and reading interviews and so forth with developers is that, you know, they are taking this type of thing into account. And the changes that they make in the areas of race and gender, and they're trying to do better. They really are, the vast majority of them. And it may not always work out the way they want it to, but a lot of these games, these medieval games, are franchises. So if they don't get it quite right in this game, you know, they're going to keep working and it's going to be better in the next game. And I think, you know, that needs to be recognized as well, that the industry as a whole is dealing with these issues and trying to remember that, you know, they don't want to attract certain audiences. They want to attract a broad audience, but not one that's going to use their hard work for any purpose that they don't approve of.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that we should give props to the gaming industry, because as you say, I do see it evolving too from my place on the sidelines. I do see it evolving and it being more complex and being something that people can engage with on multiple levels that don't necessarily lead to a simplistic idea of the Middle Ages. And you're right, we should give them props for that. So hooray for the people that are making change, because we really appreciate it. And I think it's happening because historians and gamers and the community are all pushing for that. This is what we want from our games. And I think that the studios are listening.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's talk about your favorite game before we finish up. Your favorite games are the Witcher games, you said, right?
So
what is awesome about them? Witcher 3.
Not as big a fan of the first two.
Okay.
What I love about Witcher 3 is, well, it's a number of things, actually. It's first of all that it's a complicated world. Like they have different areas have, for instance, different political systems. You go from this set of war-torn villages to a great trading city to a group of islands that's inhabited by these pirate clans. The villain is an empire, and you know, all of these political systems coexist in the same world, just as they do in the real medieval world. And all of them are flawed, and you see the flaws as well as the strengths. I love it because it's one of these rare, rare games that you actually see the perspective of the lower classes represented, especially early in the game when you're traveling through this province that's basically was the battlefront. And you meet villagers and you help them and you hear from them. You get to hear about their lives and their problems. And they're not just, you know, faceless backdrop. These are real people with real issues. I love the touches of Norse mythology. I love the world itself. It's a stunningly beautiful game. if I had played that game first instead of Skyrim, I think I probably would have looked down considerably on Skyrim. Just because it's, I mean, it's a much older game, obviously, but The Witcher 3, like, you travel through this world and you just, you're happy to stay on your horse and keep riding because it's just so stunningly beautiful. And there's the characters I love. I mean, there's real deep relationships between the characters as well. A real sense of family between the lead character, Geralt, and his adopted daughter, Ciri. It's just, it's all the best things of a medievalist game to me. And now I want to play it again. Just even talking about it, I want to pop it back in and start over.
Well, that's great, because I wanted to finish off with, there's a lot of people that are stuck inside right now. They're going to be looking for video games, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you this week. What are your recommendations for medieval video games for people who are stuck inside? We've got Witcher 3. What other ones? Are there any other ones you'd suggest?
Skyrim, any of the Dragon Age games, God of War, which is a really fascinating take on Norse mythology, the most recent God of War, obviously, not the Greek ones. There's a brand new game that I've only played a little bit of. It's called The Plague Tale: Innocence. It's set during the Black Death.
Wow.
It's a bit different. It's a bit harder. So I would suggest that only for people who are used to more difficult games. And, you know, there's been a number of re-releases of some of the old classic games like Baldur's Gate and Baldur's Gate 2. So if you're into vintage medievalism, you've even got a few options there.
That sounds great. Well, thank you so much, Alicia, for talking to us about video games. It's been awesome.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
To find out more about what Alicia's up to, you can follow her on Twitter at Merovingianist. That is MeroVingianist. Keep an eye out for Recreating Worlds, Representations of Pre-Modern History in Video Games, which will be coming to you soon. Before we go, here's Peter from Medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. But first, Peter, video games were formative for you when you became a medievalist, right? What was your video game of choice?
Oh, yeah. Like, when I was younger, the game that got me hooked into history and the Middle Ages was called Romance of the Three Kingdoms Part 2. It was like Super Nintendo. So that really dates me, but... You know, we are fighting in like 3rd century China, running kingdoms. I was a big fan of Cao Cao. Me and my friends play all night. So I had that game and another game called Uncharted Waters, where you were an explorer, like from Spain or Portugal, explore the world, go to, you know, India to get some spices, take them back to Portugal, sell them for profit. That was my kind of game.
That does sound like you, for sure.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if you can still play those games, Peter. You might need to find a new one.
I think so. Well, now there's like Romance of the Three Kingdoms, like part 25 or something like that. So it's just too fast for me. So I'll stick to Candy Crush.
Sounds good. What's going on the website this week, Peter?
Hey, first thing is we have a video by you that you posted on your channel, and then we posted on ours, and we have a post, and you talk to kids.
Yeah, talking to kids. I was very aware that there's a lot of kids that are at home now. They're not at school. And in Ontario, they were just about to get into the medieval unit in grade 4. So I thought this is a good opportunity to answer kids' questions about the Middle Ages. And the questions are fantastic. Ones about bananas and toilet paper and stuff. So
yeah,
it's awesome.
It's like a 25-minute video, so it's you go fair that you answer like 16 questions. So it's very in-depth, though. Thanks for doing that. So.
Yeah, my pleasure. What else is going on?
We've got pieces such as Steve Mulberger on the Black Death and the Hundred Years' War. You have Adam Alley talking about the Mamluk Sultan Baybars. And we also have a piece on cannibalism in the Icelandic sagas. So get your mind off of everything all terrible going on right now.
Yeah, nothing like cannibalism to distract you. Sounds great. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
As Peter mentioned, this weekend I shared that video I promised, answering 16 questions that kids sent to me, including ones on bananas, snakes, and toilet paper. I hope that you and your kids enjoy it and that it gives you inspiration to learn more together while you're at home. You can find it on my YouTube channel or on the Medievalist.net YouTube channel. Thank you and hello to all of our new patrons on Patreon for your help keeping us going. If you love the podcast, please consider supporting us by treating yourself to one of our Patreon rewards, like a subscription to Medieval Warfare magazine, either digital or on paper, or a book with our book club. Every little bit of your support is most appreciated. Check us out at patreon.com/medievalists. For the latest and greatest information about the medieval world, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. And find me, Danielle Sapolsky, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. If you need to take a break from gaming, check out my new book, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, or my other books on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Gee Frog. Thanks for listening and getting your game on with me.